Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that pits two movies with something in common in a fight to the death to see which one comes out victorious. On Monday's episode, we got lost in the woods with the Blair Witch, which means today we're staying home with our loved one and an ancient demon hell-bent on scaring us to death. From 2007, it's Paranormal Activity.
Can I get a little striptease?
No.
I think we're going to have a very interesting time capturing whatever is occurring or is not occurring.
Windows are locked, doors are locked, alarm is on.
Something's here. I feel it breathing on me.
So witch versus demon, which creature will haunt our nightmares and which will be exorcised from our memory? We'll have a winner at the end of the show, so let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clashbudders.
I'm Chris Tilly.
I'm Alex. You're not in control. It is in control, Zane. And joining us for our second show this week, we're delighted to have with us two of the team behind the brand new, bloody brilliant, found footage horror dash cam, writer and exec producers, Gemma Hurley and Judd Shepherd.
Hey. Thanks for having us back.
Can keep us away.
Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for being here. Oh, so obviously, dash cam out in cinemas now. Let me ask you this. How was making dash cam compared as an experience to your first found footage movie, Zoom?
Host,
sorry.
No, it's called Zoom in Japan.
It is. That's what you were thinking.
Yeah, I was talking about the Japanese version. Yeah. Sorry, I like to watch all my movies in Japanese.
Well, the difference, I mean, the main difference, we had a little bit more time. Like, Host, we had 2 weeks to come up with a story before they started shooting.
Something like that, yeah.
And with Dashcam, we had like a month or so. So we did it in like, you know, September, October, and then they started shooting like straight after, I think.
Still over Zoom though. We still wrote it over Zoom. The main difference, honestly, is just the software that we use. So we wrote Host on Google Docs because it had a collaboration feature.
You were going to say editing software or camera equipment. You mean Google Docs versus Word.
Yeah.
Well, Google Docs, yeah. We got a little bit fancy with dash cam, so we wrote that in Final Draft 12.
Collaborate on the collaboration.
Yeah.
So we're still like not in real life. I'd only met Jed once when we started writing dash cam, I think.
Yeah.
And I hadn't met you at all when we did Host. So that was the main difference.
Yeah.
Like, oh, now I know how tall you are.
So I've known Jed longer than you.
Yeah, you have. No, but the main difference was in Host, it was me and Rob like pitching Gemma ideas and her going, And then in Dashcam.
Hey.
And in Dashcam, she was pitching us the craziest, most goriest ideas. And we were like, Gemma, you've gone too far now.
We've
made
sick.
A monster.
I mean, to watch both films back to back, it certainly looks like Dashcam was a lot more, I guess, taxing to shoot as a movie because it's so visceral. There's so much going on. At least that's how it looks to watch it.
Yeah, well, from start to finish, for Host, it was conceived and released within a 12-week period. It's insane. So obviously with Dashcam, there was a lot more time, and like Rob and our producer Doug could do pickups and things like that for things they wanted to fix. And obviously just a bigger budget with Blumhouse involved. So you can see there's just, we throw the kitchen sink. There are so many stunts. And yeah, it's just, it's basically like kids like getting their first kind of birthday money where they can spend on all the toys they want. So yeah.
Make our audiences sick.
Yeah.
It's so extreme, like it's great, but I mean there's some pitch black humor in there as well. I'll say two words to you: just married.
We're sorry.
Do you know what I actually think that was your idea, Gem. I think
it was.
Because
make her pregnant.
Yeah, because I had the car crash. I was like, what can we do now? Let's just have a car smash into them. And Gemma was like, What if it's they've just got married and she's pregnant? I was like, wow, Gemma, what is going on? But I loved it.
Yeah, there was some darkness. I mean, like, the main difference for me about Host versus Dashcam was like Host had really strict parameters, right? Because of the time limit, you know, we knew who the actresses were. We kind of knew what was going to happen in this, you know, they're going to be attacked on a Zoom call by some kind of tulpa or demon or something. Mm-hmm. And that was all we kind of had to work around with Dashcam. It was like, whoa, like, let's just do anything and just keep trying and, like, you know, like, one-upping it each time. And I think that was more, like, a completely different tone when we were developing it as well. Yes, we were, like, laughing all the time, the same we did with Host, but we were really just trying to, like, how can we fuck each other over and, like, get this into the script a bit?
Because I remember, and I'm going to try and do it without spoilers, where I pitched a moment that happens near the end with certain blood flow. And Gemma was like, no. Like straight away, and I was like, come on. And Rob was like, yeah, we're doing that, because me and Rob are genuinely like little kids when we talk about horror. Gemma's the sensible one, and she like reins us in quite a lot, because if it wasn't for Gemma, we would be making the just bizarre non-commercial gross out movies that are more experimental, but Gemma kind of reins us in and puts, gives us structure, really. So that's why she's essential.
We'll just try and, like, you know, let's have some character relationships or something around the stuff.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe.
I was like, well, I want the car in the air, Gemma. He's like, yeah, but the person
why
inside
is the
it
car
should...
in the air? Yeah. Sorry, I'm not that much of a dick.
It's great. It's great fun. Go and see it. It's at cinemas right now. That's Dashcam. Brilliant. So thank you for making the time to come in today. We're going to be talking more about Dashcam, I'm sure, as we head through today's film, because Chris is going to be opening the front door to a house of horrors today, as he is our guide through paranormal activity. Chris takes on a journey.
Paranormal Activity is a film about three men who let down a woman called Katie. The insensitive boyfriend, the cowardly sidekick, and the demonologist who just can't be arsed. Katie's being haunted by a demon, but rather than do anything to actually help her, boyfriend Mika buys an expensive camera and uses it to work on a project of his own. When Katie quite rightly points out that the camera is making things worse, he ignores her pleas and continues to film. Then there's the psychic Dr. Fredericks, who, when the proverbial hits the fan, shows up at Katie's door to tell her she's on her own. Then finally there's the demonologist, who goes on holiday rather than help Katie. You had one job, demonologist, and now because of you, someone is dead. The end. So, Gemma, when did you first see Paranormal Activity?
Probably, I think I saw it in a cinema when it came out. It was like, what, 2007?
Seven, yeah.
Yeah, so that was like, ooh, I'm at university. I can see horror films. I'm 18. That was one of the ones I saw in the cinema, and it just blew. This is probably one of my favourite horror films, along with Blair Witch Project. It just blew my mind. It terrified me. That whole scene, I mean, we'll get into it, but there's a scene in that attic that happens that I just had nightmares about. For weeks and weeks afterwards, Jesus,
and a scene where nothing happens, which
where
is amazing.
Yeah, ooh, a bit more than the film last week.
Yeah,
yeah.
Jed,
I also saw it in the cinema, and again, this is just my jam. Anything even remotely like this is my jam. Found footage. I think after Blair Witch came out, there were just thousands of found footage films that tried to like jump on the trend, and they were all awful, to be honest. And they set found footage back a long time, but then Paranormal Activity came out. I was like, oh, wow, there's a good one again. There's a great one. And like Gemma said, it is one of the, it's in the top two best found footage films ever, and in the top probably 10 horror films for me. When I first saw it, I was just very jealous that someone had done this before me. I was like, this is so good, and it's so simple. And it basically created the template for Blumhouse films in the future. A family and a supernatural thing happens, and they get an expert in. The expert doesn't really help very much, and people die. That's the Blumhouse
it's
formula.
So true.
Yeah.
And I promise this is the last time I'm going to mention your podcast this week, but Eduardo Sanchez says on that, this is the film he wished he'd made.
Yes.
But there were all these pretenders to the Blair Witch Crown afterwards, and they were happy they hadn't made them, and then they watched this one and thought, man, why didn't we do that?
Mm. Yeah, and then, and conversely, I can't remember if it's on the podcast or if I cut out some gold, but Oren Peli, he was a massive Blair Witch fan, and he would basically essentially stalk Eduardo Sanchez and say, hey man, I'll just, let's have a meeting, I'll buy you coffee, I'll buy you lunch, can we just talk about films? And they did that, and it kind of inspired Oren Peli to make Paranormal Activity, to give him the impetus to kind of get his own thing together, because he's a massive Blair Witch fan.
Amazing. Alex?
I was reviewing for a newspaper at the time this came out, and I couldn't make the press screening that all the journalists go to together. So they put on a screening, and I assumed there would be other people there, but it was just me.
No way.
So I watched Paranormal Activity on my own in a screening room, which you'd think would be fine because you know there's an entire office the other side of a door, but it doesn't help. It was one of the most terrifying experiences I've ever had in a cinema, watching this on my own.
I bet. My first viewing was a press screening, but there were people in it. And as I said on Monday, as a grown-up, only two films have given me nightmares, Blair Witch and Paranormal Activity.
Wow.
And worse still, that the night after I watched it, I was asleep and my bastard brother came in my room and pulled the sheets off my bed and terrified me. And I was fucking living. And the next day, the morning, I went down to his room to have a go at him and he wasn't home. And he hadn't been home that night. He'd stayed at a friend's house.
What?
So this was all in my head.
What?
I guess I had a nightmare, but it felt real. And I remember shouting at my brother, and I guess it didn't happen. He wasn't there, but it something messed up happened that night.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's scary.
Anyway, should we talk about the making of the film? So this one all starts in 2003 when Oren Peli moves into a house. This house, the house in the movie. And it's the first time he'd ever lived in a detached house. And he said that when he was living in apartments, you'd hear constant noise, and that was the people around you. But when you're in a detached house, you hear a noise. It's the house making the noise.
So interesting.
And he said he started getting scared. And it's funny, you said on Monday, I'm in my property, nobody can invade my house. This is what Oren Peli was thinking. What if the noise is coming from in here? What's going on? I keep hearing noises. And he said, I knew it wasn't a ghost, but it made me feel vulnerable during the night. And I thought, well, that feeling is universal.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, I mean, I get that. I get that a lot. Being in your home and not feeling like safe, like I have nightmares about people getting into the home, but not even like people, not your classic intruder thing. Like I do believe, like, you know, I've run out of room. It's like if I turn the light out, if I've watched a horror movie and I turn the light out in a room, I will then sprint to my bedroom as fast as possible, because, and then I'll lock the bedroom door. I had locks put on every door in my house so that I can lock out monsters.
How old were you at this point?
This is
now.
This is now. I realise how insane it sounds, but the idea of monsters still terrifies me.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And like, it's just a classic horror movie trope that something scary is something that's like domestic, something invading your family. That's the scariest thing of all, your family and your friends and you getting hurt.
Your safe space is not safe.
Exactly. Because like, all very well going into the woods, that's, you're inviting that onto yourself because you're going to the place where the scary thing is. But if you're at home just chilling, there shouldn't be any scary things.
I guess you could call this a home invasion movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally, yeah.
It's just the invasions coming from inside the house.
Yeah. There was a Stephen King short story in his compilation Night Shift called The Boogeyman, and it was about a creature that came out at night and it always killed his family's babies, his firstborns, over the years.
Yeah.
And, like, they'd find footprints in the corridor, the father would, of this thing, and it just lived in his wardrobe and it came out at night. And to say it out loud, you're like, and that was scary.
It was
genuinely like the idea of something locking yourself into your home and thinking you're safe and then finding out that the thing is actually in your home and you've locked yourself in with it.
Yeah, you know, Rob Savage is making the Boogeyman movie right now.
Mm. Based on that story?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Come on, Alex.
He's making it right now.
I did a lot of research. Which was a lot of information. Is he really?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's in the editing mode for it now, so...
Awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Oh, that's great.
So Pelly's idea was, what if you set up a camera at night, filmed what was happening, and then how freaky would it be to watch the footage back and something did actually happen?
Yeah.
So he spent a year planning this film. He didn't know what he was doing. He learned about cameras. He had to figure out what special effects he was capable of creating and wrote around that, which is kind of how you approach host, isn't it? Like some of the gags were based around what people were capable of doing themselves in their houses during lockdown.
100%. Like when we first had the meeting with the cast, we were just like, okay, we've got a list of like the kind of scares, but if you guys have anything in your house that you can pull down, connect with a wire, and let's stick that in. So 5 minutes later after that meeting, Hayley sent us a video of her sitting in a chair and her chair getting pulled back. And this is without any VFX. And we were like, well, how did you do that? And it was just literally, it was like rock climbing ropes on the back of the chair that her boyfriend, Kieran, pulled. And we kept, that's in the film with like no VFX around it. So yeah, it's just we use what was around us, and in some respects, that's what we did with dashcam too.
I was going to say, but was it freeing with dashcam that you didn't have to write it happening in a bedroom or a back garden that you could actually open up the world?
That's true, but yeah, it was what Lucky 13 could do. I think wasn't that?
Yeah, that's
Rob
a stunt
was like,
team. Lucky 13.
Yeah, he was like, "What would you like to do? Let's do that." Kind of thing. So I think there was more collaboration in that.
Yeah,
sense.
The whole thing is a collaboration. And I think with these fan footage films, they have to be collaboration because you're really relying on the your protagonist to kind of pull something out of the bag and to find gold. So it's interesting.
And you talk about that collaboration on the commentary for Paranormal Activity, which is one of the best commentaries I've ever heard. It's a brilliant masterclass in making a movie. Oren Pelly talks about the fact that a lot of these found footage films that follow Blair Witch messed up by casting bad actors.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a big thing for him. That audition process was finding people who could be spontaneous, intuitive and think on their feet. Katie and Mika auditioned. They got the gig. They're called Katie and Mika in the movie, as we've discussed on Monday. It's a simple way of doing things to keep it easy for your actors. But he said he wanted them to be blunt and honest and sometimes annoying, as that's what real couples are like, and have fights and have conflicts, but still love each other at the end of the day. And I think you get that from these characters.
Yeah.
They feel like a real couple.
I think, again, like Heather in Blair Witch, Katie's a real find. Mm. She's so natural.
I'm not so sure about Mika. Sorry, Mika.
No, you are right. She carries this movie, and this movie is again one of the biggest return on investments of all time. And it's Katie who carries the entire movie. If you don't believe her in her authenticity, then the movie dies. But again, it's all on her shoulders, and she smashes it.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because like you really, it's you're right. It's such an incredible performance, in so much as she somehow gives this air of a woman who has come to live with the fact that there is a demon in her life, and that's just life for her. She's aware that it's there. She's not. She don't want to piss it off. That's all Mika. Yeah. She's just like, this is me. It follows me around.
I mean, this was a big thing that he says, is that he didn't want her to be hysterical.
Mm.
He wanted the authentic, because he said when he did a lot of research into ghosts and demons, decided to go with a demon, and then when he'd be watching these stories back, it was people who've just come to terms with this being in their lives, even though it's made up. But it's funny you say that about Mika. He said that when he would, you know, stand at the back of the cinema and watch people coming out, he said a good percentage of people would say how much they hated Katie, and a good percentage would say how much they hated Mika.
How could you hate Katie?
Yeah, that's
who are
weird.
These people?
I guess maybe because she hasn't been honest with Mika, as he said. Like, she's brought this demon into their world, and she's sort of kept it from him, that this thing tends to return regularly.
Sure. But when she finally goes, right, look, I'm sorry about that. I should have told you. Probably don't piss it off, though. That's when he should listen, and rather than go, well, I'm probably going to piss it off as much as possible.
Agreed.
But it's like, I mean, like, without getting too, like, metaphorical and English lit about it, like, it's a metaphor as well for, like, the something horrible happening in her childhood, this demon. It's not necessarily something you tell someone ever, maybe. Like, and it's like, does she trust Mika enough to tell him? And I don't know if he's earned that trust based on his personality.
That's so true.
So I don't know, but people don't like Katie, apparently. I can't figure this out.
It seems to be a theme, right?
I wonder why. I mean, this, comparing this to Blair Witch Project last week, this is a film where people start acting strange when they are exhausted and when they feel hunted, and there is that kind of that synergy there, which is, yeah, I mean, other than that, like, I can't figure out too many other parallels apart from these strange dynamics that are forming between, like, the male and female characters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's there. But also, the house is the third character in this movie, and he said he quickly realised that his house wasn't working. It's the house that's used, but there was carpet all over the place, the walls were too white, there was no art on them, there was no rail on the staircase, so he had to convince his girlfriend to let him remodel the house to make the movie, which he did. He said it was improvements he wanted to do for a while, and it was the only way the movie would work. So, remodeled the house, and then they shot it in 7 days.
Wow.
They scheduled 5 days, and they added another 2 in case they needed reshoots, which they did. And then there were days of reshoots afterwards, but what we see is basically what they shot in a week.
Crazy.
Holy shit.
Crazy.
It's amazing.
Well, Blair Witch was just 8 days.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
This was 7.
One better.
He said he then... but he said then they did some ADR at Katie's apartment, and he said it was a very easy to do ADR on this film because the characters are off screen a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And there's one key moment, actually, where there's a really useful bit of ADR that they were able to do that sold a scene that wasn't working.
Interesting.
But
do you think he showed his wife this film afterwards? Because that is a house she then has to sleep in forevermore. If that was my house and I'd watched this movie, I would never be able to separate out the fact that I'm watching a work of fiction from the idea that this is my house.
Well, I don't want to go on record with this, but he does refer to his girlfriend at the time.
Right.
So maybe
could be a wife?
Could be wife.
Yeah.
Nah, I don't need to say it like that. I don't think he'd say it like that. But he tinkered with the film for a year. He said, some days I watched it back and think we'd made the next Blair Witch. Other days I thought it was unreleasable. He kept flipping back and forth. But when the film was done, he read some books on how to get the movie seen.
Wow.
And this is when it becomes a story of incredible rejection.
Yeah.
Every festival turned it down. Every producer turned it down. The only festival that said yes was Screamfest in LA, which is not a big festival.
No.
But you've got critics there, and the guy who runs the festival said send out screeners, and then they got a great review in Dread Central, Bloody Disgusting, LA Weekly, played one in front of the audience. People kept telling Oren that it gave them nightmares the next day, but... No one wanted this film. The only people that vaguely were interested were DVD companies at the time, but he felt theatrical was the way to go. So he held out, he got involved with the CAA agency. They were trying to sell it to direct-to-DVD. He kept holding out, and that's when Jason Blum got involved. His partner, Steven Schneider, loved the film, showed it to Blum. He liked it. They agreed to partner and potentially release it theatrically, and then there were some cuts happened. They tweaked the movie, because Blum said, if you tweak it, you can resend it to people you've sent it to before and say it's a new cut.
Nice.
And they did that, got rejected again.
Yep.
Someone at DreamWorks liked it, but they didn't buy horror films. They didn't really buy films, DreamWorks. And they wanted to remake it with a big budget, big stars, and they were going to let Oren Peli direct it.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And he said no.
Wow.
He did not want... He felt like he'd made a film that could be released in cinemas. And so it got accepted into Slam Dance. It got good reviews there. And he was going to go with the DreamWorks deal. But there was something in the contract that said before it happened, DreamWorks executives had to do a test screening that they would attend. So they screened it for a test audience. The executives came. And before the screening ended, the bosses were talking about giving it a wide release and coming up with ideas for TV spots.
Amazing.
Wow.
So that happened really fast.
Wow.
Based on an audience reaction.
That's great.
No one seemed to be particularly happy with the ending, though. So they'd agreed they would work on that. And then a couple of days later, the head of DreamWorks said, we're going to release your film, but we need Steven Spielberg's approval. He'd apparently watched it, but stopped it halfway through. And the way it got back to them was because he didn't like it, but apparently it was because he was too scared. So he got up the next day, watched it in daylight, thought it was brilliant, loved it, gave his approval and said, I've got an idea for the ending, which they used, but we'll get to that.
Okay.
When we talk through the film. But then DreamWorks broke up. But yeah. Paramount acquired it. There was even problems there because Paramount hadn't been at any of these test screenings. But they released the film and the rest is history.
Okay.
So, should we talk about the movie?
Mm. Yeah.
Let's dive in.
Right. In America, this film doesn't have any company logos at the start, which is amazing. We do here in the UK version, but all that came up was Paramount Pictures would like to thank the families of Mika and Katie and the San Diego Police Department. Now, you like a title card, Jed. We've established that.
Yes.
How are you feeling about this one?
I admire that so much. And I know we actually wanted that for Host, didn't we?
Mm-mm.
We didn't. We didn't want any logos at the start so people would buy into the authenticity, but unfortunately we're contractually obliged to. And then like in that dash cam, the Blumhouse thing, but the Blumhouse thing's cool, their little kind of ident. But if it was up to me, there would be no credits and no logos at the start. It would just be the footage. That's how every good fan footage should start.
It's all about selling the lie. So it's September 18th, 2006, and Mika's filming Katie. He's brought a camera to chronicle whatever paranormal activity is happening. He starts filming everything. And so Mika is, he's a day trader. And I think that plays into his personality. He's confident, he's cocky, he's fearless, and he takes risks.
He's an alpha male.
He's an alpha male.
Yeah, he's very competitive. Mm-hmm. Like he's like obviously he's competitive with a demon. Like it's, I mean,
you're never going to win that battle, are you? Yeah.
It's insane that he's like, you know, this is my house, this is my girlfriend. Yes. You know, I'll take you on. It's like you can't even see it. It's a demon.
Toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Well, coming from a financial background myself, working in finance, you do see demons every single day. So,
in the mirror.
Good point. I can see his competitiveness with a demon would be easy for him.
And Katie is an English major and she's hoping to become a teacher. So that scene where they're making dinner, Oren Peli gave them the camera, asked them to make dinner and talk, and then left. And they shot the evening's footage themselves together. And then he watched it back. That was their first night. He liked some of it. He didn't like some of it. They reworked it. They shot it again the next night, and then they were rolling. Like they'd figured out who these people were and how they were, how the process was going to work. And it takes a while to get to the first scare here. How do you feel about that when you're writing your scripts? Do you feel pressure to have an early scare in your movie, or do you like to take your time?
You've got to set the tone. Mm-hmm. We try to do that with both the films. Like let you know what kind of movie you're watching. Like, you know, this is the kind of rule. So in Host, we had like a little thing where like, ooh, there's like there's a bumping sound. Like, what is that? Turns out to be a false scare, but you still kind of like set up those expectations.
Yeah. And I think Host is an interesting example because Act One is the majority of the movie. Yeah. And like, it's just the introduction of these characters. And because we want you to like love these characters, so when bad things happen to them, it really hurts. Mm. We kind of don't have any scares in Host, proper scares, until the end, really.
Well, yeah, halfway maybe,
About halfway we have the attic scene, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, Host is like a 60-minute movie. You're right. It's like, I'm sure it's quite frustrating for some people. Like, when is things going to get scary? But all of that frustration is just like anticipation.
Mm. Exactly. And he was asked to quicken the pace. And whenever he did, the film was less scary, the audience was saying. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting, something quite specific here. He said he thinks that the notion of these people filming each other on their cameras at home made people antsy and anxious. And it rewired their brains to think they were watching a real home movie rather than a movie.
Yeah.
So that slow pace at the start was key to having your brain in the right mode for what's to follow.
And even though it is slow, I mean, again, we are joining this couple like where this is already happening. It's not that, you know, she has already been haunted by this thing. Like one of the first things Mika says about the camera is, I bought it to film this paranormal activity that is going on in our house, which is great. You know, there's no sort of like, oh, what's that in the night? It's like, there is something out there. We know it's out there. I want to capture it.
Yeah,
such a good point, because if we did capture their very first haunting, it wouldn't feel real because why would the cameras be set up? So that's really interesting.
I'm going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, it's night number one.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And we're back with night number one. 2:08 in the morning, low rumbling, creaking, footsteps on stairs, jangle of keys, silence. That's the subtitles, which I used when I was going through this film, which were quite helpful. But that first shot, as I say, nothing much happens. But he said he spent months trying to get that shot right, where the bed was, the actors were, the doorway in the frame, to being able to see in the hallway but not view it clearly. So you're never sure where to look. And he got the shot right after figuring out that he needed to put a lamp on a dresser off camera facing a wall. That was the key, and it took him a long time to get the exact right. And I guess it works because the beauty of this film is you're looking around the frame.
Yep. That shot is iconic. That shot.
Terrifying.
I don't mind some of the sequels. I can't remember which is which anymore.
Three's the best. Yeah. The ones in the 80s.
Three's amazing.
It's sort of amazing that, like, the more cameras they added sometimes and the more they tried to do with the cameras, nothing really beats, for me, the simplicity of this one shot and returning to this one shot night after night. And it's sort of being like, you know, you can go, right, the shot is the shot. So then you're only paying attention to the different things the demon does in the night, is the way it's escalating the haunting of this house.
Yeah.
Although, you do find out later that the demon's sort of maybe hanging out in the loft, and you do then, once you found out there's the loft and that there's a little rickety stepladder up to the loft, and Katie actually says to me, gotta be careful on that thing. And then every time after that, like, you watch it and you see the light come on at the end of the corridor, you're like, that's safe, that demon, because it's got to climb down a ladder, so it puts the light on first. And I couldn't stop thinking that. I was like, clever, you got a stepladder to go down, stick the light on first.
So we meet the psychic Dr. Fredericks now, who plays down the chances of it being a haunting. And we get Katie's backstory. So this started when she was 8. It happened in their first house. Then there was a fire in the house. And then from 13 onwards, this would happen periodically. And the past few weeks, it's been happening again. I think it's just the right amount of backstory. I mean, watching the sequels, there's a lot of backstory have.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what the demon's called. I wish I didn't. Do you remember what he's called?
No.
Toby.
Oh,
oh, right. Okay.
Is it really?
Toby, yeah.
Toby, the unfriendly ghost.
I'm glad we don't find that out here, but there's a good use of language. You shouldn't underestimate, like, the fact that the language that they use when she's describing what she sees at the end of the bed, and she calls it a mass. And just like the use of the word mass is like, ooh, there's something creepy about that. So it is very cleverly written, some of the words.
Yeah. Mm. And just what you were saying, Alex, before, the composition of that shot, the iconic shot of just the bed, the doorway, and it's quite cinematic, but in a believable way, because again, with Host, doorways and empty doorways especially are the scariest things in horror movies, because it's your imagination that fills in. Your imagination doesn't have like a budget. You can just it can be anything in that doorway, and that's far scarier than filling it with a man in a rubber suit or something. Just holding that shot of like an empty doorway is scary.
It's that anticipation, isn't it? Which is what this film's all about. It's that build up. The psychic gets a tour of the house, which is always useful, showing us the audience the geography of where we are. And he's not comfortable with what's in that house. He gives Katie the number of a demonologist.
Let's not forget, Mika is actively rude to a man who has come to help out. He's like, bullshit. I mean, he doesn't say that. I can't remember what he says, but it is basically bullshit.
I don't know. I'd find it hard to take a psychic seriously.
Yeah, but you'd still have a common courtesy not to say it to their face.
Like, what, someone who's lying to my wife to get money out of her?
Yeah.
But in this instance, he's not.
Yeah, because he knows that it's real. Like, I think I really do. I know I'm a lady banging on about toxic masculinity. I'm self-conscious of that. But like, it does feel like the real demon in this film is like, you know, like, I don't want any other dudes fixing my problem for me, and that feels like where the problem escalates, and it starts with that scene.
Yeah, uninvited as well. Yeah. She doesn't ever go, Mika, please help me with this. It's like all him sort of driving it forward. He's like, you know, he's just so fucking like blasé about it as well. Like when he's like, so do you know any tricks to get this going? Because I'm bored. You know, where's the demon? Can you just call him or something? He's like so flippant about it, which we can talk about at the end, because I think it plays into the end.
Night number 3 at 2:09. There's a low rumbling, door handle rattles, door creaks and opens. There's a sort of almost half jump scare here where Katie screams, but it's a spider. Did you like the fact that he grabs his camera before going to help her? Is that what you two filmmakers would do?
Yeah, because do you know what? Like, I personally don't believe in ghosts or monsters or anything like that. But if there was the chance of capturing one, like, I'm the kind of person who I really want to believe, like the Fox Mulder poster, I want to believe because that it would mean that there's something else out there, not just us. So I would definitely grab my camera or my camera phone and try and capture something if I knew it was going to be there.
I was going to say, let's be honest, Mika's main priority isn't for the health and welfare of his partner. It's to dominate and control the situation. Yeah. So it makes sense.
Because we didn't really touch on this as well, because obviously, like, when they get around to calling the demonologist, he's not there, he's gone on holiday. But the reason they don't call him immediately is, again, because Mika says, do not call the demonologist. So if they called him when the psychic gives them the number right away, he might have been there. But no, Mika says, don't call him. And by the time they get around to calling him, he's on holiday.
I don't think demonologists should be allowed to go on holiday if they are this important to these equations.
Demons don't take holidays, so demonologists shouldn't.
Exactly.
do you think, just about Michael really quickly, do you think the fact that he's a day trader, they gave him that job title to make you think, okay, this guy reacts to data and to fluctuations on a daily basis, and he commits his actions to the things that he can see and physically. There's something to do with his job title and the way he acts in this film, I think.
And also, it means he's at home all day as well.
True.
He can do it from the computer, and like it, you know, it's sort of, I guess, because his home is his workplace. It's like, this is my everything. So that's why he controls it. Because you know how controlling you are at work, like, or he is if you're a trader, you know, he brings that into the home. So there's no separation. It's not like he comes home to relax or anything. Yeah. He's sort of always on at home.
It's true, yeah.
This is the moment where he gets slightly annoyed that she's never mentioned the whole demon thing before. He then locks the doors and Katie counters with, whatever's happening, it's already here. Night number 5, 2:55 in the morning, low rumbling, whispering. Katie gasps and wakes with a fright. She's had a nightmare and there's a loud bang. They play the tape the next morning and they hear this unintelligible voice. The thing wants to communicate with them. And
my name's Toby.
You find out it's Toby in Paranormal Activity 3, I think.
I think so, yeah.
Three, right?
Yeah, yeah, because it's all to do with, do you know the whole mythology? It's the grandmother made a deal with the demon, and now the demon wants the firstborn son, and these are two daughters, and it's been passed down through the family, but the family sort of brought it on themselves, the three generations up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I do like the bit where Mika does ask it a question. He goes, would you be happier communicating through a Ouija board? And you hear that ever so slightly, slight change. And you go,
Oh, we'll jump to that bit then. So night number 13, more happens. It's more of the same, really. That question gets asked. Then we're in night number 15 at 1:36 a.m. low rumbling. Katie gets up. She seems to be in a trance. She turns around. She stands and she stares at Mika for 2 hours. With creepy. The clock speeding up. This what a great idea.
It freaked me the fuck out, this scene. When I first saw it, I was like, well, how is this scary? But it is just standing
it's
over
It's so
him.
Simple, but so effective. And that was, she was just going to stare at him for 30 seconds, and then he suddenly had the idea to speed up the clock.
Yeah. No, I had a girlfriend that used to sleepwalk, and she did that to me once. I would just wake up in the night, and then she would be in the middle of the room just staring at me, but in a kind of a trance, and I'd just be like, I need to get rid of this girl.
Oh, that is dark. Mika goes looking for her and finds Katie rocking in a chair on the porch. Poor old Oren Peli, he says that the question he gets asked a lot is, how did Katie get out without setting off the alarm? And he always answers, it's just something demons can do.
Yeah, yeah.
Well done, Oren, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't
I can't
matter.
Imagine thinking of that.
No.
But he says that in his mind, this is the demon doing a test run for seeing how much it can overpower and control Katie. Mm-hmm. It hasn't tried anything quite this much yet in terms of getting her to leave the room. So Mika borrows a Ouija board. You know about Ouija boards, you two.
Yeah.
Love them. Mm-hmm.
Do you?
I have a whole bunch of them. Yeah. Like I kind of collect them, I guess. I don't believe in them, but I think they're kind of cool to have. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I bet they're all better than this one because they just printed out what looks like a Ouija board and stuck it to a bit of plywood. Yeah. It looks like an expensive Ouija board in the movie, but you know, they were doing this on a very low budget. And
they were banned at our school after we went on a residential once, and some of the lads decided to do a Ouija board at night, and wow. And then they said that it told them that the bus was going to crash on the way back from the residential, and cue the following morning, every girl in the year was crying their eyes out and refusing to get on the bus home because a Ouija board had told them it was going to crash. It's kind of like a really, really parochial final destination.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Oh, it's actually like we were talking earlier on off pod about the band Ash. You know, I wrote a little film thing for Ash, and it involved them doing a Ouija board. So it, and basically, and this is a genuine story, they did this Ouija board as part of this like video that they were going to go on a DVD of them doing a Ouija board, and Mark got possessed for real, and he refused to go on stage after that because he was acting weird. And then Channel 4 made a documentary called Love and Destruction. You can find it on YouTube, of Mark from Ash, the bassist from Ash, his exorcism.
Oh my god!
And that was all because I wrote this little thing for them doing the Ouija board. This was a few years back.
All right,
yeah,
we'll
check
post
that
out on the old Twitter.
Yeah, that's love amazing. And destruction.
Because I mean, I you know, if I do genuinely, I have it in me to want to believe. Sort of that always that battle with cynicism and that sort of desire, like you said, for the X-Files. You know, I want to believe. Yeah. But yeah.
Have you ever done a Ouija board?
We've done a lot of seances.
Oh, so many.
Yeah, so I feel like it's the same kind of territory.
For fun or research?
Well, we did I felt like we did 50 on Host.
We did loads in the lead up to Host, just so we knew the beats, so we could just write about seances. And especially doing seances on Zoom, we didn't know how that would go, so we did that. And then afterwards, every single person asked us to do a seance with them for press reasons and interviews. Yep. Okay, here we go again.
Anything weird? Anything weird ever happen, even once, even slightly weird?
Well,
not want to believe.
Well, post-Host,
Emma
was very scared because it was filmed in their own houses, and Emma, they're all believers, Emma wouldn't go to sleep in her own house anymore, in that bedroom where she filmed it in. So she would just either call me or text me until the sun comes up, and then she would go to sleep. She was like, the sun's come up, I can go to sleep now.
Oh my God.
Because she thought there was a guy standing in her room.
We gave them PTSD, yeah, basically.
So I had to buy her sage. I had to Amazon her some sage so she could burn it in her house in order to get rid of this the demon from host.
I shouldn't be laughing. Yeah.
No, but, honestly,
you're terrible people.
Yeah. What I love about this, it goes to show like how interesting the human brain is and how susceptible we are to this, and how we like what we, you know, our narratives, what we think is going on can like change reality, which I think, you know, happens in the Blair Witch, and it also to some extent happens in this film. They're kind of like their negative energy or like what, you know, trying the is feeding off them wanting it to, so you know I think it's just a testament to that.
So this Ouija board bursts into flames. the next day, Mika's trying to figure out what it's written, and the names Edina, Nadine and Diane come up.
Has it scorched an image of a demon onto it? I couldn't tell. You know, there's something that's like, it looks like there are two eyes and a demonic kind of shape from where it caught fire. Did anyone else see that? Or am I seeing things I want to believe?
I thought that was just the markings, and because like the yes and no were like two eyes or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no, I'll go back. It probably is, actually. You're probably right.
I wonder.
But what does happen is this name, which does come back a little later. But Katie then agrees to Mika's powder experiment. And so they put powder on the hallway. And in the night, 3:15 a.m, low rumbling, heavy footsteps. Mika wakes up and there are footsteps in the powder. He finds the door to the attic. He gets a ladder. You're right, that is terrifying. I wrote down terrifying.
Oh,
that is terrifying. He looks around up there, and as Oren Paddy said, in a normal horror film, something would jump out, but we purposely didn't do that here. We wanted to defy horror conventions and audience expectations.
Yeah.
So instead, he finds a burnt photo of Katie in front of her old house. And they did that all in one shot, and they only did that once, and they nailed it.
For me, that was a redeeming moment for Mika, because I was like, you know what? Like, I hate you, you shithead, but well done. Like, well, having the courage to go up in that ladder, because I would not.
When the ADR comes in, because the version they shot, he runs out and runs up there.
Mm-hmm.
And Pelly said, when I watched it back, he was too much like a movie character. He was actually too heroic.
Yes.
And so they ADR'd him saying, I'm not going in there. I'm not going up there. Yeah. I'm just going to look. And suddenly the scene worked, because he seems more real. He seems more vulnerable. He seems more like a normal person.
I don't know whether it's a happy accident or it was done intentionally. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say it was done intentionally. But after we've seen the footprints appearing and the powder on the floor, when Mika climbs up to the attic and Katie's sort of holding the ladder, so she points the camera back down towards the floorboards, and you are waiting for a footprint to appear in that shot while the camera's pointed at the ground, because we've just seen them a moment ago while he's up in the attic.
He's not happy with the footprints because he said too many people have told him they look like chicken footprints, or asked them but they were dinosaur footprints. And so he says he wished he'd made them a bit more abstract so it wasn't quite so clear, because he said in actuality that's not the demon's feet, that's just how it's choosing to manifest itself. And this is all about this, what it's doing there is just part of its plan to draw attention towards Katie's photo up in the attic.
We're inspired by a lot of movies for Host, and Host we have a whole footprints in the powder scene as well in that bit.
She's normal footprints.
I think VFX a little bit easier than they were back then, so we made them look like human footprints.
I love it. I really like the footprints in the powder in this. It just, because it makes you realise there is a physical, invisible thing walking around at night, which, with power as well. It feels like a powerful thing.
They argue about who is control, and I'm going to quote Alex, quoting the film, "You are absolutely powerless," says Katie, which is a terrifying concept.
Wow.
Demonologist on holiday, call Dr. Frederick, and then night number 18, 3:53 a.m. Low rumbling, lights turn on, footsteps. Mika wakes up, lights go off, door slams, loud bang from outside, door rattles. They do some investigating and they hear three knocks on the door, head downstairs, hear creaking footsteps, and then they finally go to bed. But the next morning, Katie's on the couch and she looks terrified and shattered, and it's sad when we know what's about to happen, really, because she's broken at this point.
Mm-hmm.
This demon's breaking her.
The three knocks is really symbolic. Anytime three's in the horror movie, it always makes me think of the fact that, especially when it's to do with like ghosts and otherworldly stuff, just Thomas doubting Christ like three times, that thing, that always plays in my mind. Like, is that the reason why they picked three? And I'm guessing it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it is. Now everything changes because they're having dinner and it's daytime. And they hear a loud bang from upstairs. And they find a picture of them smashed, but it's Mika's face who's cut up.
This is like the slime bit in Blair Witch.
It's like,
you know, singling out one person.
And this is a scene that was added afterwards. This is one of the reshoots because they wanted to show the entity becoming more confident, which is why it's active in daylight. And they wanted to threaten Mika so he'd be more open to finding a solution and accepting Dr. Fredericks coming back.
Come at me, bro.
And Dr. Fredericks does show up. He feels something quite over Parry when he gets to the door, and he is out of there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he literally opens and goes, "Fuck this! Nope, not going in there." It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable! Yeah. Bloody hell, Fredericks! But that's their last hope gone. Night number 19. Two incidents on this night. 1:30 a.m. The sheet next to Katie starts moving independently and sort of reveals her foot, and then sort of moves her foot. He said he placed this shot all over the film because it could happen at any time.
Yeah.
But he said initially it was at the start, but it worked better here when the audience is sort of primed for something big to happen. And you're just given something small, which is, did you find with something like dash cam, when it gets so hectic, you do need, towards the end, you need a moment of quiet every now and then? Or do you just want to keep powering?
You do need dynamics because you can't just keep someone on the edge of their seat the entire time. You need to give them a little moment to breathe out so you could start the process again.
Yeah, I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
Unsustainable for an audience, yeah. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So 3:04 a.m, the landing light turns on and they hear a knocking and the light goes off and they hear a low grunting. Katie wakes Mika and she says she felt it breathing next to her. She could, next day, she says she could feel it watching her.
Would you not? I mean, I know, like, Katie's whole thing is, look, wherever I go, it'll follow me. There's no point leaving, it'll follow me. You would go out into a public place, though.
Yes.
You would go and sleep in a dormitory somewhere, or like be around people, or be outside the house, whether or not the logic dictates. Wherever you go, the demon will go. You'd still do that. You just wouldn't sit in that house on your own.
You wouldn't. And you would change your sleep schedule a little bit. I would sleep during the day and be awake during night and not be in that house as well. And also, I think they should have kind of separated and gone their own way, because there's lots of things you could have done to prevent the ultimate outcome, I think.
Obviously, it's not sustainable. That is your home. You can't just, like, keep moving around forever, like it follows or something. But you could, until the fucking demonologist comes back from his holidays, you could go, right, let's fuck off out of here.
Let's go on holiday.
Yeah. When he comes back, then we'll just get him over rather than stay here and wait to die.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was two things that kind of broke my sort of believability with this film. It was like, why don't you just spend the night in a hotel or something? And the second thing was, I wasn't sure why they never seemed to have friends around. Like, especially for Mika's personality, I thought he'd want to show off the demon.
She has a friend over, but he doesn't. Maybe he doesn't have any friends.
Yeah, that's
day trading. Yeah, you don't make many friends doing that.
But, you know, to like have a proper like, guys, look, come and see. Like, you know, and I wanted that. I was surprised why they didn't do that. But then there's so many psychological reasons why you might want to like.
Or budgetary reasons.
But also, maybe it's embarrassing for him because, you know, he has like a straight-laced job. He doesn't want people to think, oh, he's kind of kooky. I'm not going to trust him with my investments or whatever.
Mika finds Diane Mercer on a website who's experienced the same stuff in the 60s. She called an exorcist. They tried to get rid of the demon. They made it worse and she died. Diane is one of the names that was on the Ouija board earlier. So that was the demon telling them, I killed her. Don't think about exercising me, because this is what happens.
Wow.
I think that's the message here.
Yeah.
And they show you this freaky, grainy footage of Diane, which I don't think works. But it's the first time we're out of the aesthetic of the film, and it first time I'm being reminded I'm watching a movie, which is surely not the point with this.
A complete mistake, I think. I think if they could go back, they would get rid of that, because it really takes you out of the moment.
And there was a lot more of that originally. That's actually the pared back version of it, but just... get rid.
It's like in the Blair Witch Project, they originally had other footage, like newsreels from Rustin Park stuff and some other things they had in the film, which they kind of took out and they put on the website instead.
You know what? I don't even remember this, and I saw it like a year ago, so obviously just like, it's irrelevant to the film.
Good. All right. Well, I'm glad you don't remember this bit, because It's shite. Night number 20, 4:31 a.m. We're near the end now. Katie slides off the bed and gets dragged down the corridor. The door slams behind her. Mika chases after and manages to bring her back screaming. Pelly said this gets the biggest reaction in a cinema, that scene. He said poor Katie had to do that over and over again as well.
I can believe that gets the biggest reaction. It's terrifying. Like, it's one thing having a sheet dragged off. You imagine if your invisible brother had dragged you out of bed at night down the corridor.
Bastard Pete. So the next day she's got a huge red bruise on her back, which looks like something's bitten her. They decide to go and sleep in a hotel. So it is building up to that moment. And then he finds Katie sort of half asleep, half in a trance, holding a bloody cross to her thigh. So what do you make of that moment?
I probably wouldn't burn it in the next scene. I think that's a mistake. Burning a crucifix at any time in a movie like this is a bad idea.
I think if you're believing some of the Heather stuff we were talking about on Monday, this is potentially Katie's last moment of being herself, of sort of humanity, and she grabs the cross to try and protect herself one last time before she's sort of gone forever.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the blood is. It could be stigmata.
I thought she was squeezing it so tightly, it had ruptured her hand.
Yeah, could a cross do that? The other thing I thought is it some kind of stigmata?
I mean, that's a good shout, but then what would that actually mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't work.
Or is it all she's already possessed and it's sort of rejecting her?
I think that could be it. But is that cross also maybe the last thing in the house that is protecting her? Because as you say, Mika burns it along with the photograph.
Yep.
And then all bets are off. The next morning he wakes her and says, "We're leaving." And she says she wants to stay. Mm-hmm. He pleads with her and she says, "I don't want to go. We'll be okay. It's better if we stay." And then when he's gone, she sort of slightly demonically says, "I think we'll be okay now." And then she smiles at the camera.
It's great.
That voice, the effect that they put on the voice, great.
Do you know they also do a visual effect there that he figured out how to do? Her eyes start smiling before her mouth does, just by a second. He sort of split her face and got this bit to move.
Wow.
And so that's why it's just uneasy watching it. But he said that was about the only digital effect I could figure out to do in the film.
That's genius to even think to do that. Yeah.
Simple but effective. Yeah. And now we're in the end game. Night number 21, 1:27 a.m. Katie wakes up, stands up, turns and stares at Mika. The covers slowly move off his body. She walks around the bed and stands over him for nearly 2 hours. Mm. And then 3:14 a.m. she walks out of the room, starts screaming. He runs to help her. Then there's silence. Then slow footsteps up the stairs. You heard him scream just before this. And then Mika is thrown into the camera. That's really Mika doing that stunt. She has blood on her. She stoops to sniff him, maybe. Pelly says he doesn't know what she's doing there. And then she crawls towards the camera, smiles, and with a demonic face attacks the camera, and that's our final shot.
I'd forgotten they threw Mika's body at the camera, and I've seen it. This would be the third time this week. Scared the shit out of me all over again. Oh, I completely forgotten. It's such a good jump scare.
So effective. And again, we've taken a little bit of that for host as well. There's things flying out the camera. And
We stole everything.
Yeah, we did.
Pelly said, so that's the ending that Steven Spielberg suggested.
So what was
Oren, the original? I'll get to it, but Oren Pelly said he thought this was too over the top until he watched it with an audience, and then he realised it was just fine. So the original ending...
It's all online as well.
All online. But the original ending, it's all the same at the beginning in terms of Katie leaving, Mika running down, screaming. The original ending, Katie returns... She's got blood on her. She rocks back and forth for a day. Cops enter the house and confront her. And it sort of brings the film back into reality and connects with the mention of the police at the start of the movie. He said that ending didn't really deliver. He was never sure about it. But then the alternate ending, which is on the Blu-ray as well, Katie comes up with blood on her. She's holding a knife. She walks towards the camera and she slits her own throat and dies.
That makes sense, because I wondered what that bit was at the start where he mimes slitting a throat when he's in the kitchen with the knife. And I couldn't remember the end. I was like, he's going to get his throat slit at the end. That's how he's going to die. He's just mimed his own death without realising it. But it's that.
But regarding what you said and the 2016 Blair Witch, the reason Pelly was happy to remove that one was because it was the first time they introduced gore in the film.
Yeah. Mm.
And he liked the cleanness of it just not being there at all.
Well, I really actually like the version where she's against her bed, just rocking back and forth. Because in my mind, that's her slightly going back into her old self and having remorse for what's happened. Because she's just like, what have I done? And it's her coming to terms with it. And then the police turns up. She doesn't really put up a fight. I mean, they're all interesting, those endings, especially post the film being a massive success.
Mm. I think I would have the ending that they used, but I don't think I'd have her demonic face come in the camera. I just think I'd end with her smiling.
Yeah.
I think that would creep me out more.
Yeah, because you've already done the jump scare of something flying at the camera, so it's just a repetition, isn't
it? Yeah.
The words on the screen are, Mika's body was discovered by police on October the 1st. Katie's whereabouts remain unknown. And he said, Pelly said they had arguments about whether they needed that text. And I actually don't think it's necessary at the end.
I like it.
Do you?
Yeah, I like it. I like the idea that she's out there in the world. She's escaped. She's off doing her thing as a demon.
But he also said he couldn't believe that Paramount let them finish the film without any credits. So the film just ends there.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Well, what they did, if I remember correctly, is they just put a website address, right? And then you have to go to the website address to find the credits. Yeah.
Maybe that is it. It's just one card with some Paramount information on it. So maybe the website's there, but it does just stop dead, which is...
Yeah, it's great. That's great.
It's ballsy.
With that. Yeah.
So I don't think we did the numbers, Alex, but the budget for this one was... I mean, this is Wikipedia I'm going by, but 15 grand budget, 215 grand post-production. And then 193 million gross. Blair Witch, anything between 200 and 500 grand. Obviously, the original cut of it cost 50 grand or whatever it was. But and that grossed $248 million. So these are two of the most financially successful films of all time, sort of, you know, cents to dollars. Will this still happen? Can this still happen? I guess it can. You guys did host. It's not done 250 million yet, has it?
Don't trust the Wikipedia.
No, there was one point on Wikipedia that said the film made $270 million. I was like, really?
Where's my money, bitch?
For real? I did not realise that. I do think, again, it's very prescient that found footage films are the ones that make the most money because they're the ones that scare us the most, I think, because they play with our idea that that cinema is safe, watching something on your TV is safe. Found footage films remove that barrier and puts you in the film where people are using their real name, there's real situations. And with Host, like, it makes you feel like you're on that Zoom call with them. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no pretense there.
Or you're in that car in dash cam.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So... I think if people want to make a movie that potentially could make a whole ton of money and really affect people, make a found footage movie, but don't make a bad one. Like, find a way to make something original because it could potentially could be critically and, the audience loves it too.
Well put. So, any more?
No, it's me, Dom.
Okay, so let's do the bits. Emma, what was your favourite scene?
Yes, that attic scene. Although, now you've mentioned it, that one where you hear them screaming and running down the corridor, that gives me chills. But yeah, I think it's got to be the attic one because I'm just in Mika's shoes for the first time going like, oh, I really don't make me go up there. Please don't make me go up there. And it's just, you're just waiting for something horrible to happen. But I love how they twisted your... expectations with, you know, finding the photo instead of a jump scare.
So good, isn't it? Because you can't even make out what it is initially. Yeah. It's just this weird, like, amorphous shape in the middle of the screen.
Oh yeah.
Oof. Jed,
my favorite bit is Mika being flown at the camera. Just because it's such a cool jump scare in a movie that doesn't have that many jump scares. I think it's iconic. And not to promote myself, but I'm doing a video game where something like that features as well. And I studied that bit in Paranormal Activity so many times to work out the timing of when's the best time to do it.
And it's interesting, that was the one thing that Steven Spielberg brought to the movie.
He could make a career out of
this. He knows what he's doing.
I mean, there is a little bit of a lineage from Poltergeist, which I know he didn't direct as such, but he was around on the set like all the time. To this, like, it's a similar situation.
And then Oren Peli obviously went on to produce the Insidious films, which has that same theme of it's not the house that's haunted, it's the person. Alex?
I know he doesn't like them. I know Oren doesn't like them, but I love those footprints. Those footprints are great because, you know, they do look inhuman and they look like something that shouldn't be walking around invisible at night. They scare me. It gives it gives it a presence. It makes it a thing as opposed to just doors slamming and what have you.
Yeah. Cool. I'm going for Katie standing by that bed for hours. Just that concept of someone standing over me, watching me all night, really frightens me. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? All different. Most valuable whatever, Jed.
I'm going to go with return on investment again. Like the, just because I think people need to, because I find that found footage films are much maligned, not only in general, but in the horror community as well. And any chance I get to fly the flag for found footage films, I'll do so. And I'm trying to persuade, because I, even after Host and Dashcam, I'm still in these meetings where people go, oh, are you sure you want that to be found footage? Don't you want to make a conventional film? Because they just don't trust it. And I'm just like, look at the money, look at the figures. So yeah, the return on investment, it made infinity money based on this budget, and also basically kickstarted Blumhouse, which has produced so many great movies, including our own. So if it wasn't for that, then I don't know where we'd be.
Gemma?
Does this count? Like, for me, it's the silence in this film. Mm. Like, it's, I mean, it's the, like the opposite film to Dashcam in a lot of ways. But I just love how it, yes, it can be frustrating. Yes, it takes its time, but there's so much silence and stillness and you're just always just like, and it really just gets under my skin. And there are not many films, I think, that utilize silence as much, but when it's done well, it works. And Paranormal Activity is the one.
The only other movie I can think of that's similar and has that stillness, I don't know if you guys see it, but Lake Mungo.
Oh, yeah.
Which is another kind of faux documentary style film, but it's the stillness in that, it's the scary
part. It's not easy to see, but well worth seeking out, isn't it, Lake Mungo? It's a great movie.
Yeah.
It's so true about the silence thing, because once you've got that silence as a sort of baseline as well, you like the most minute introduction of any kind of sound, like a low hum,
listen out,
suddenly becomes quite ominous.
Yeah. And that's the thing we haven't discussed in both these episodes, the fact that there is no music telling you where to be scared, which it's your mind telling you when to be scared when a scary thing's happen. It's not just like violins, and it's kind of like gestating in your mind.
Yeah. I'm going to pick Oren Peli. I mean, he bought a book on directing. He bought a book on effects. He bought a book on how to market your movie.
Well,
he
done,
just
mate.
Did this all himself in his house. I think that's so inspiring. It, you know, like what you guys have done. I think this should be a lesson to everyone, really. Alex.
Yeah, Oren Peli as well. I just think that whole conceit of the repetition of the same shot of that camera over the bed night after night is a sort of a reset of like, okay, it's this next night, and using that as the base for the escalating events, I think is great. I think that's genius. So, Oren Peli.
And if you could change anything in this one, what would you change? Gemma?
Mika's acting. Sorry. That's really mean. That's really mean. Or I'd have...
Too late now, no.
Then have a dinner party.
And Mika wouldn't speak. Jed?
I would take out that kind of grainy video showing you a bit of the exposition. That could have been on a website or something. It's unnecessary. It takes you out of it. But yeah.
Alex?
So Mika is a dick. I think we've established that, which is a problem at the end, because after you overcome the initial jump scare of him flying at the camera, you're like, well, yeah, he was going to die, wasn't he? Like, I don't feel any remorse for him as a character dying. Mm-hmm. He's the only character to die in the film. And yet you really, you know, you've never empathised with him. You don't have any sympathy for him. So it's sort of like, well, he spent the movie asking for it from the demon directly, and now he's dead. And I just think there is, I think it's important that Mika's character is the way he is. But I just think, just explain it to us a little bit better, in so much as he was bullied at school, which has made him an alpha male later in life. His boss emasculates him at work as a day trader. Just something that explains why he is so like protective of this house and his world and all of that. Just so I can sort of sympathize a bit and have a bit of remorse at the end, like make him someone who I go, that's a shame that he died.
So he's a bit of a dick and he deserves to die because of it. It's really hard.
I mean, I don't like day traders.
Okay, fair enough. I would absolutely remove the scene where Dr. Fredericks comes back over to the house and then turns around and leaves. I mean, it's some, you know, I remember watching it in the cinema and people laughing in that scene, and maybe you do need a bit of light relief, but I don't think it's there for that reason.
No. It's so funny.
And, you know, have him just put the phone down on her or something. But I just, I think his acting's a bit off there, and it just, again,
well, this place gives me the heebie-jeebies.
It completely takes me out of the movie, and it could be easily excised.
Yeah,
but do you think he did that because he, like he'd said in interviews, like he wanted to subvert horror conventions, and the convention usually is
they this say, yeah.
demonologist comes in and almost like saves the day, and yeah, so he
you're absolutely right, but it could happen over the phone, or it, they could just reshoot the scene, so it's funny, and it should, I don't think it should be that funny.
I'm sort of split, because I do know what you mean, because after that moment, and when that coupled with the fact they can't get hold of the demonologist, it's like you are, it's a real, like, it's a very depressing final act, because you are waiting for the inevitable to happen when they've run out of options.
Yeah.
Okay, I can't take it back. Okay. It's still my change.
I'm not angry. I'm not angry.
Just disappointed.
All right, then, there we go. That is Paranormal Activity, which means now it's time for the verdict.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
So I picked these movies this week, which means I'll decide who gives their verdict first. Chris, would you like to go first?
Sure. I love both of these movies. As I said, the last two horror films to really properly give me nightmares. So I think they're fantastic. But there is a winner for me this week, an outright winner. And it's the film that hits me on a primal level. And it's The Blair Witch Project. It just makes me feel all strange emotions. Sometimes I find bits of it stupid, bits boring, bits annoying, bits frustrating. But it's all they all serves a purpose, those emotions. And then towards the end, it makes me feel really sad and then completely devastated in that final shot as I'm sort of reevaluating what I've seen and heard before, and also when I'm just thinking about this person dying. And so for that reason, it's one of the greatest horror films of all time, Blair Witch Project for me.
Okay. Jed?
This one's an easy one for me. Much as I like Paranormal Activity, The Blair Witch Project is probably the best horror movie of all time for a number of reasons. Obviously, the return on investment, which I'd like to stress. But also, it's just this legacy. The legacy of the Blair Witch Project will live on long after us. And it basically kickstarted this subgenre, which I think is the best subgenre of horror, because it kind of generates real fear in us, because the authenticity of found footage makes us feel scared. And I just want to feel scared. Mm. That's it gets the adrenaline pumping. And The Blair Witch started that. Paranormal Activity continued it, and it is really high up there in the list of best horror films ever. But for me, Blair Witch Project is perfect.
All right, two for Blair Witch so far. I might jump in here if that's all right, Gemma. So I do think it's very close. I think both films are very good. I enjoyed rewatching them this week. Location plays a big part for me, and you touched on this earlier, Jed. So the woods are already scary. At night, woods are terrifying, which is why I do not find myself in the woods very often. However, I am at home a lot. I like being at home. And so the idea of an invisible entity stalking the corridors of, I'm bigging up my house too much, the corridor of my house at night is, for me, the stuff at nightmares. And also, while I said on Monday, I really admire the ambiguity in The Blair Witch, I love the fact that there is a thing, there is a monster, there is a demon in Paranormal Activity. That scares me more than The Blair Witch. So my vote is for Paranormal Activity. So, Gemma, you go Blair Witch, it wins. You go Paranormal, it's a draw.
I think, and this is to, I'm going to echo what you said, Chris. I think it's going to be Blair Witch for me. It is like literally one of my favourite films. Yes, we never know if it's really a demon, but I think it's something we've touched on with The Paranormal Activity. When Mika dies, I don't care. I don't have that like sadness or like, you know, like melancholy. But when Blair Witch, you do have this connection with Heather by the end, and you do feel for these guys. And for me, that's what elevates it to a superior horror film. It's just you do by the end of it, you're like, there's this loss there, that there's a tragedy. And whereas in Paranormal Activity, it's just like, and also like by the end, like what's her face is Katie. She's no longer herself anymore. So she's already kind of disappeared. So you just have this sort of like, it's almost like everything sort of fades away towards the end in terms of your like connection with the movie. Blair Witch for me.
Well, we have a winner. It is the Blair Witch Project. Our co-host who's missing this week, Vicky Crompton, said also Blair Witch. So it is 4-1 in favour of Blair Witch. It is a unanimous victory for the Blair Witch Project. Congratulations.
Excellent.
Right. You happy? I thought you were happy.
I am. Yeah. I'll tell Eduardo as well. He'll listen to this.
Oh, lovely. I hope we said nice things about you. We love you, Eduardo.
He'll probably listen to the Blair Witch episode.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Too late.
Right then. Let's quickly look ahead to next sure. week. Chris, what was the clue you gave on Monday?
Both these films are a real drag.
And the films are...
Well, I thought we needed to lighten things up a little bit. This has been a harsh week. So we are doing Tootsie and Mrs. Doubtfire.
Hey! Wow.
Tootsie is available to rent Google, Amazon, YouTube, and Mrs. Doubtfire is on Disney Plus in the UK.
Lovely business. That is your homework for the weekend. Tootsie versus Mrs. Doubtfire on next week's, Clash Pod. A massive thank you to Gemma Hurley and Jed Shepherd for
thank
coming
you.
In
thank
today.
You for
cheers,
us.
Chris. Cheers, Alex.
It's been wonderful having you here. Congratulations
thank
on
you.
Dashcam. Very exciting. Out in cinemas now. Go get some friends. Go to your local cinema. Have your minds blown. In the meantime, we will be back on Monday. Remember, homework, Mrs. Doubtfire. Tootsie. Follow us on Twitter at ClashPod and Instagram at ClashPod, and also subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your pods. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this yeah. shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.